I could not bring myself to look down to see what lay below. I dared not risk turning to discover just another deep hole. If I saw that, I would stop immediately, and then what? A desperate struggle to remain on the rope, fighting against the steep pull of the slope, unable to regain the ice bridge, but frantically trying to hang on as long as possible. No, I couldn't look down. I wasn't that brave. In fact, I was having enough difficulty staving off the dread which swamped through me as I descended. It was this or nothing. I had decided that on the bridge, and now I was committed. If it was to end here, then I wanted it to be sudden and unexpected, so I kept my eyes fixed on the ice screw far above me. The slope became steeper. When I was about 50 feet below the ice screw, I felt my legs swing suddenly beneath me into open space. My grip stopped the rope involuntarily. This was the drop I had seen from the bridge. I stared up at the bridge, trying to make myself release the rope again. I had experienced the sensation in the past, standing on the edge of a high diving board, watching the water drops falling free from my hair to the pool below, as I waged a mental battle to convince myself that there was nothing to it, daring myself to do it, and then off into space with a heart-stopping swoop and laughter as I plunged safely into the water below. The knowledge that I could abseil until the rope ran out and then fall into space as its unknotted end whipped through the belay plate made me clench the rope even harder with my frozen hand. At last I released it, and the old feeling that the pool might suddenly move to one side or the water empty as soon as I dived returned once more, though I didn't know this time if there was a pool to aim for. I abseiled slowly over the drop until I was hanging vertically on the rope. The wall of the drop was hard, clear water ice. I could no longer see the ice screw, so I stared into the ice as I continued to lower myself past the wall. For a short while it held my attention, but as the light around me grew fainter, the dread spilled over and I could contain myself no longer. I stopped. I wanted to cry, but couldn't. I felt paralyzed, incapable of thinking, as waves of panic swept through me. The torment of anticipating something unknown and terribly frightening broke free, and for a helpless, immeasurable time, I hung, shaking on the rope, with my helmet pressed to the ice wall and my eyes tightly closed. I had to see what was beneath me, because, for all my convictions, I didn't have the courage to do it blind. Surely it could not make me any more frightened. I glanced at the rope stretched tautly above me. It ran up the wall and disappeared onto the slope above. There was no possibility of getting back to that slope some 20 feet above me. I looked at the wall of the crevasse close by my shoulder. On the other side, another wall of ice towered up 10 feet away. I was hanging in a shaft of water ice. The decision to look down came as I was in the process of turning. I swung round quickly, catching my smashed knee on the ice wall and howling in a frenzy of pain and fright. Instead of seeing the rope twisting loosely in a void beneath me, I stared blankly at the snow below my feet, not fully believing what I was seeing. A floor. There was a wide, snow-covered floor 15 feet below me. There was no emptiness, and no black void. I swore softly, and heard it whisper off the walls around me. Then I let out a cry of delight and relief which boomed round the crevasse. I yelled again and again, listening to the echoes, and laughed between the yells. I was at the bottom of the crevasse. When I recovered my wits, I looked more carefully at the carpet of snow above which I was dangling. My jubilation was quickly tempered when I spotted dark, menacing holes in the surface. It wasn't a floor, after all. The crevasse opened up into a pear-shaped dome, its sides curving away from me to a width of 50 feet, before narrowing again. The snow floor cut through the flat end of this cavern, while the walls above me tapered in to form the thin end of the pear, barely 10 feet across and nearly 100 feet high. Small fragments of crusty snow pattered down from the roof. I looked round the enclosed vault of snow and ice, familiarizing myself with its shape and size. The walls opposite closed in but didn't meet. A narrow gap had been filled with snow from above to form a cone which rose all the way to the roof. It was about 15 feet wide at the base and as little as 4 or 5 feet across at the top. A pillar of gold light beamed diagonally from a small hole in the roof, spraying bright reflections off the far wall of the crevasse. I was mesmerized by this beam of sunlight, burning through the vaulted ceiling from the real world outside. It had me so fixated that I forgot about the uncertain floor below and let myself slide down the rest of the rope. I was going to reach that sunbeam. I knew it then with absolute certainty. How I would do it and when I would reach it were not considered. I just knew. In seconds, my whole outlook had changed. The weary, frightened hours of night were forgotten, and the abseil which had filled me with such claustrophobic dread had been swept away. The 12 despairing hours I had spent in the unnatural hush of this awesome place seemed suddenly to have been nothing like the nightmare I had imagined. I could do something positive. I could crawl and climb and keep on doing so until I had escaped from this grave. Before, there had been nothing for me to do except lie on the bridge trying not to feel scared and lonely, and that helplessness had been my worst enemy. Now I had a plan. The change in me was astonishing. I felt invigorated, full of energy and optimism. I could see possible dangers, very real risks that could destroy my hopes, but somehow I knew I could overcome them. It was as if I had been given this one blessed chance to get out, and I was grasping it with every ounce of strength left in me. A powerful feeling of confidence and pride swept over me as I realized how right I had been to leave the bridge. I had made the right decision against the worst of my fears. I had done it, and I was sure that nothing now could be worse than those hours of torture on the bridge. My boots touched the snow, and I stopped descending. I sat in my harness, hanging free on the rope a few feet from the floor, and examined the surface cautiously. The snow looked soft and powdery, and I was immediately suspicious of it. I looked along the edge where the floor joined the walls, and soon found what I was looking for. In several places there were dark gaps between the ice walls and the snow. It was not a floor so much as a suspended ceiling across the crevasse, dividing the abyss below from the upper chamber where I sat. The start of the snow slope, running up to the sunshine, lay 40 feet from me. The inviting snow carpet between me and the slope tempted me to run across it. The idea made me chuckle. I had forgotten that my right leg was useless. Okay, crawl across it. But which way? Straight across, or keeping near to the back wall? It was a difficult decision. I was less worried about putting my foot through the floor than by the damage such a fall would do to the fragile surface. The last thing I wanted was to destroy the floor and leave myself stranded on the wrong side of an uncrossable gap. That would be too much to bear. I glanced nervously at the beam of sunlight, trying to draw strength from it, and made my mind up at once. I would cross in the middle. It was the shortest distance, and there was nothing to suggest that it would be any riskier than at the sides. I gently lowered myself until I was sitting on the snow, but with most of my weight still on the rope. It was agonizing to inch the rope out and let my weight down gradually. I found myself holding my breath, every muscle in my body tensed. I became acutely aware of the slightest movement in the snow, and I wondered whether I would end up sinking slowly through the floor. Then some of the tension in the rope relaxed, and I realized that the floor was holding. I breathed deeply and released my aching hand from the rope. I sat very still for 5 minutes, trying to get used to the precarious feeling of being balanced above a huge drop by a fragile sheet of snow. I belatedly realized that it was something I couldn't adjust to, and that there was no choice but to attempt to cross the gap. I let out 40 feet of rope, and tied the remaining 30 feet to my harness. Then, lying spread-eagled on my stomach, I began to wiggle stealthily towards the snow cone, anxiety easing as I got closer to the other side. An occasional muffled thumping told me that snow had fallen away into the drop beneath the floor. I would freeze rigidly at the slightest sound, holding my breath and feeling my heart hammering before moving off again. The black holes in the floor were all behind me when I passed the halfway point, and I sensed that I was now crawling over thicker and stronger snow. After 10 minutes I lay slumped against the slope rising towards the golden sun in the roof. The abseil rope hung in a curve before the ice wall and the steep slope above it running up to the ice bridge. If only I had known there was a floor down here, I could have saved myself a lot of grief. The thought that I might have waited up there made me shudder. It would have been a drawn-out vigil of madness and cold. At the end I would have slipped into exhausted unconsciousness after enduring days of consuming despair. I glanced up the snow cone. For a brief moment I wondered whether I'd been deluding myself with the idea that I could possibly reach the sun above. It was a long way, and steep. I would be able to climb the slope while still tied to the rope. As I gained height, the rope would rise with me until it hung almost horizontally between the snow bridge and the sunroof. A fall at any point would not prevent me from crashing straight through the floor, where I would swing in a pendulum in the lower cavern until I hit the ice wall down which I had abseiled. If that happened, there would be no return to the snow cone or the ice bridge. I thought of climbing without the rope. At least the end would be mercifully quick. I dismissed the idea. I needed the rope. It gave me a feeling of security. A slight breeze ran through the crevasse, and I felt it on my cheek, a chill, deathly brush from somewhere deep below me. The light in the chamber was a strange mix of blue-grey shadows and dancing reflections from the ice walls surrounding me. Rocks embedded in the walls stood out starkly in the wet, translucent ice. I rested at the base of the snow cone, absorbing the feel of the crevasse. For all its hushed, cold menace, there was a feeling of sacredness about the chamber, with its magnificent vaulted crystal ceiling, its gleaming walls encrusted with a myriad fallen stones, shadows facing into darkness beyond the great gateway formed by the ice bridge which hid the silent vault beyond. The menace was in my imagination, but I couldn't stop it playing on my mind, as if this thing had waited for a victim with the impersonal patience of the centuries. It had me now, and without the sunbeam I might have sat there numbed and defeated by its implacable stillness. I shivered. The air was uncomfortably cold, was well below freezing. A puff of wind outside sprinkled powder through the hole in the roof, and I watched fascinated as it drifted in the sunlight. It was time to climb. I stood up gingerly on my left leg, letting my damaged limb hang uselessly above the snow. It had stiffened during the night, and now hung shorter than my good leg. At first I wasn't sure how to set about climbing the slope, which I guessed to be 130 feet high, 10 minutes' work with two legs. It was the angle of the slope that worried me. To begin with, it rose at an angle of only 45 degrees, and I felt confident that I could drag myself up that. But as it gained height, so the angle increased. The top 20 feet looked almost vertical, but I knew that my eyes were being confused by looking straight onto the slope. I decided it could be no more than 65 degrees at the top. The thought wasn't encouraging. Loose powder would be exhausting enough without the injury. I suppressed a growing pessimism by telling myself that I was lucky to have found a slope at all. The initial steps were clumsy and uncoordinated. I dug my ice axes deep into the snow above me, and then hauled myself up the snow with my arms. It wouldn't work on the steeper slope above, and I realized how risky it was. If an axe ripped free of the snow, I would fall. I stopped and tried to work out a better method. My knee throbbed painfully, harshly reminding me that I was a very long way from getting out. Patterns. I remembered how I had traversed to the col with Simon. It seemed so long ago. That's the way. Find a routine and stick to it. I was resting on my axes, looking at my good leg buried in the snow. I tried lifting the injured leg up parallel with it, and groaned as the knee crunched and refused to bend properly, leaving the boot about 6 inches lower than the good foot. Pain flared up as I leant down and dug a step in the snow. I tamped it down as much as possible, then dug another smaller step below it. When I had finished, I planted both axes in the slope above, gritted my teeth, and heaved my burning leg up until the boot rested in the lower step. Bracing myself on the axes, I made a convulsive hop off my good leg, pressing my arms hard down for extra thrust. A searing pain burst from my knee as my weight momentarily came onto it, and then faded as the good leg found a foothold on the higher step. I shouted an obscenity which echoed comically round the chamber. Then I bent down to dig another 2 steps and repeat the pattern. Bend, hop, rest. Bend, hop, rest. The flares of pain became merged into the routine, and I paid less attention to them, concentrating solely on the patterns. I was sweating profusely despite the cold. Agony and exertion blended into one, and time passed unnoticed as I became absorbed with the patterns of hopping and digging. I resisted the urge to look up or down. I knew that I was making desperately slow progress, and I didn't want to be reminded of it by seeing the sunbeam still far above me. After 2.5 hours, the slope had steepened considerably, and I had to be especially careful when I hopped. There was a critical moment when all my weight was on the axes driven into the loose snow, and the angle forced me to balance my movements precisely. I had nearly fallen on 2 occasions. One hop had missed the good step, and I had slithered into the smaller step below, with my knee twisting beneath my weight. I had struggled to remain standing, fighting off the nausea and faintness. The second time, I had hopped successfully, but too explosively, and had lost balance. Again, I felt things move and grind in my knee as I swung violently forward into the snow to stop the fall. It was odd to curse and sob and hear the sounds repeated in the chamber below. Even more peculiar was the feeling of acute embarrassment at complaining like that. There was no one to hear, but the looming empty chamber behind me made me feel inhibited, as if it were some disapproving silent witness to my weakness. I rested with my head against the snow. I was soaked in sweat, but it cooled quickly when I stopped. Soon I was shivering. I glanced at the roof above and was delighted to see the sun nearly touching me. Looking down, I saw that I was two-thirds of the way up the snow cone. The chamber appeared even more cavernous from my high perch. The rope hung in a crescent from my harness to the ice screw at the ice bridge. I was level with the bridge, and the rope hung clear of the slope down which I had abseiled, stretching out 80 feet above the floor of the chamber below. Looking at the ice bridge, I felt disturbed at the memory of my time spent on it. It was hard to believe how desperate I had been in the night and while abseiling, now that I was reaching for the sun. That was the hardest thing I'd ever done, and thinking about it, I felt a surge of confidence build in me. There was still a lot to fight for. I turned into the slope and began digging steps again. It took another 2.5 hours to reach a point 10 feet below the hole in the roof. The angle of the snow had become almost impossibly difficult, and every hop had to be a measured gamble against losing balance and making the step. Fortunately, the snow conditions improved as the cone narrowed, and I found that I could get a solid axe placement in the ice wall to my left. I felt exhausted, despite the approaching roof. The pain reached a level and then stayed constant. No amount of care could prevent the temporary weight I had to place on my knee, and I felt weak and sickened by the repeated twisted, crunching spasms in the fracture site. I bent into the slope again and hopped, pulling up powerfully on the axe I had placed in the wall, and got my boot into the step without hurting the bad knee. The snow roof brushed my helmet. I was directly beneath the small, head-sized hole in the snow. The glare from the sun was blinding, and when I looked down, the chamber had disappeared into inky darkness. I hefted my leg into the new step I had dug and prepared to make another hop. If anyone had seen me emerge from the crevasse, they would have laughed. My head popped up through the snow roof, and I stared gopher-like at the scene outside. I kept hold of the axe planted in the wall of the crevasse, and stood on one leg with my head stuck out of the snow, swiveling round to take in the most stupendous view I had ever seen. The ring of mountains surrounding the glacier were so spectacular that I hardly recognized what I was seeing. The familiar peaks had taken on a beauty I had never noticed before. I could see ice fields and delicately fluted ridges, and a dark sea of moraines curled out of sight from the snout of the glacier. There wasn't a cloud in the sky, and the sun glared from its azure emptiness with ferocious heat. I stood silent and stunned, unable to accept that I was at last free again. My senses had been so battered that I'd forgotten what to expect at this moment of escape. I hauled my hammer from the crevasse and dropped it into the snow outside. When I hopped and rolled out of the yawning drop, I lay against the snow, numb with relief. I felt as if I'd been fighting someone too strong for me for far too long. Though the sun warmed through my back, I still shivered. The heavy weight of despair and fear which had been with me for so long in the ice chamber seemed to melt away in the sun. I lay inert on the snow, with my face turned to the glacier below, and my mind empty of thoughts. The relief washing through me left me light-headed and weak, as if I'd used up the last reserve of energy within me. I didn't want to move and risk disturbing the contentment and peace of lying there, motionless in the snow. The blessed relief from tension and darkness and nightmare images was total. I realized then just how frantic I had been during every second of the past 12 hours, and in response, my mind shut itself off from all but the sensation of relaxing. I felt drowsy from the sun and wanted to sleep and forget. I had succeeded beyond my wildest hopes. I had escaped without ever thinking I could, and for the moment, that was enough. I did not sleep, but lay silent in a half-conscious limbo, slowly adjusting to my new world. I flicked my eyes from view to view without moving my head, registering the familiar landscape as if for the first time. The glacier, like a frozen tongue, curled away to the north and broke into a maze of crevasses on the black moraines at its snout. The moraines tumbled chaotically through a wide rocky valley until they thinned to mud and screes on the bank of a circular lake in the far distance. Another lake flashed sunlight off its surface just beyond the first. Serapo blocked my view, but I knew that the second lake ended at another bank of moraines, and beyond that lay the tents. Slowly it dawned on me that my new world, for all its warmth and beauty, was little better than the crevasse. I was 200 feet above the glacier and 6 miles from base camp. The tranquility evaporated, and a familiar tension returned. The crevasse had been only a starter, How foolish to have thought that I had done it, that I was safe. I stared at the distant moraines and the glimmers of light from the lakes and felt crushed. It was too far, too much. I wasn't strong enough. I had no food, no water, nothing. And again I felt the menace surrounding me. I almost believed that I wasn't going to be allowed to escape. Whatever I did would lead to another barrier, and then another, until I stopped and gave in. The black moraines and glittering lake water in the distance mocked any hope of escape. I was in a malevolent place. A tangible hostility enclosed me, as if the air had been charged with static electricity. This was not the playground we had walked into so long ago. I sat up and looked bitterly at the frayed rope end which I had carried up from the crevasse. "This is getting ridiculous," I said aloud, quietly, as if afraid something might hear me and know I was beaten. As I gazed at the distant moraines, I knew that I must at least try. I would probably die out there amid those boulders. The thought didn't alarm me. It seemed reasonable, matter of fact. That was how it was. I could aim for something. If I died, well, that wasn't so surprising, but I wouldn't have just waited for it to happen. The horror of dying no longer affected me as it had in the crevasse. I now had the chance to confront it and struggle against it. It wasn't a bleak, dark terror anymore, just fact, like my broken leg and frostbitten fingers, and I couldn't be afraid of things like that. My leg would hurt when I fell, and when I couldn't get up I would die. In a peculiar way it was refreshing to be faced with simple choices. It made me feel sharp and alert, and I looked ahead at the land stretching into distant haze and saw my part in it with a greater clarity and honesty than I had ever experienced before. I had never been so entirely alone. And although this alarmed me, it also gave me strength. An excited tingle ran down my spine. I was committed. The game had taken over, and I could no longer choose to walk away from it. It was ironic to have come here searching out adventure, and then find myself involuntarily trapped in a challenge harder than any I had sought. For a while I felt thrilled as adrenaline boosted through me, but I couldn't drive away the loneliness or shorten the miles of moraines tumbling towards the lakes. The sight of what lay ahead soon killed the excitement. I was abandoned to this awesome and lonely place. It sharpened my perception to see clearly and sharply the facts behind the mass of useless thoughts in my head, and to realize how vital it was just to be there, alive and conscious, and able to change things. There was silence, and snow, and a clear sky empty of life, and me, sitting there, taking it all in, accepting what I must try to achieve. There were no dark forces acting against me. A voice in my head told me that this was true, cutting through the jumble in my mind with its coldly rational sound. It was as if there were two minds within me arguing the toss. The voice was clean and sharp and commanding. It was always right, and I listened to it when it spoke and acted on its decisions. The other mind rambled out a disconnected series of images and memories and hopes, which I attended to in a daydream state as I set about obeying the orders of the voice. I had to get to the glacier. I would crawl on the glacier, but I didn't think that far ahead. If my perspectives had sharpened, so too had they narrowed, until I thought only in terms of achieving predetermined aims and no further. Reaching the glacier was my aim. The voice told me exactly how to go about it, and I obeyed while my other mind jumped abstractedly from one idea to another. I began a one-footed, hopping descent of the face below the crevasse. I headed diagonally to the right in order to bypass a steep rock buttress which was directly beneath me. Once past it, I saw that the snow ran smoothly down 200 feet to the glacier. I glanced up at the ice cliff above the crevasse. It was a dim past memory, until I spotted the rope hanging down the right-hand side, and knew with a sudden pang that Simon had also seen it. The string of colour hanging down the ice dispelled any doubts I might have still clung to. He had survived and seen the crevasse. He hadn't gone to get help. He had left in the certain knowledge that I was dead. I looked back to my feet and concentrated on hopping. 10. Mind Games. The snow was deep, and the sun softened it. I planted the axes firmly into the snow, and leant on them heavily while I executed a hasty downward hop-come-kick. I had only one chance at making a secure step with the kick. The damaged leg hung slackly above the snow. Despite taking care, I often snagged it, or the sudden downward jolt would pull at the knee joint, making me cry out. When I next looked at the glacier, I was pleased to see that it was about 80 feet from where I stood, and that there were no crevasses or bergschrunds between me and the bottom of the slope. The surface of the slope, however, was changing, and I was alarmed to see patches of bare ice a few feet below me. I managed 2 more hops before the inevitable happened. I knew it would, and had prepared myself for it. As soon as I hopped onto the ice, my crampons skittered off, and I tumbled sideways. I fell head first on my right side, and tobogganed down the slope on my windproof jacket and trousers. My boots rattled over the ice, knocking my legs together, and producing flares of agony to which I responded with eyes closed and gritted teeth. It was short, fast, and terribly painful. When I came to a stop in a build-up of snow, I lay absolutely still while the pain throbbed up and down my leg. I tried to get the good leg off the bent-back injured knee, but as soon as I moved, a dreadful stabbing made me scream and remain still. I raised myself and looked at my legs. The crampons on my right foot had caught in the gaiters of the good leg, so twisting my knee back in a familiar, distorted shape. When I reached forward to free the spikes, fresh pain stabbed through my knee. I couldn't free them without bending further. Eventually, I managed to unhook the spikes with an axe, and I laid my leg gently onto the snow, straightening the knee slowly until the agony faded. I had come to a stop 10 feet from a meandering line of footprints. I pulled myself over to them and rested. It was comforting to find the prints. I looked at their shadow marks trailing sinuously across the glacier towards a distant circular-shaped crevasse. The glacier rolled away from me in undulating waves of snow, and between the waves the tracks would disappear, only to reappear on the crest of the next wave. I needed the tracks. From my position, lying on the snow, I had a very limited view ahead, and without the tracks I would have little idea of where I was heading. Simon knew the way down, and without a rope, he would have taken the safest possible line. All I had to do was follow. It took some experimentation before I found the best method of crawling. The soft, wet snow made it hard to slide. I quickly realized that facing forwards on one knee and both arms was too painful. I lay on my left side, keeping the injured knee out of the way, and through a combination of pulling on axes and shoving with the left leg, I made steady progress. The bad leg slid along behind like an unwanted pest. From time to time I stopped to eat snow and rest. Then I would stare vacantly at the huge west face of Sulu Grande above me, and listen to the strange thoughts echoing in my head. Then the voice would interrupt the reverie, and I would glance guiltily at my watch before starting off again. The voice and the watch urged me into motion whenever the heat from the glacier halted me in a drowsy, exhausted daze. It was 3 o'clock, only 3.5 hours of daylight left. I kept moving, but soon realized that I was making ponderously slow headway. It didn't seem to concern me that I was moving like a snail. So long as I obeyed the voice, then I would be all right. I would look ahead and note some features in the waves of snow, then look at my watch, and the voice told me to reach that point in 30 minutes. I obeyed. Sometimes I found myself slacking, sitting in a daydream, lost to what I was doing, and I would start up guiltily and try to make up time by crawling faster. It never let up. I crawled in a mechanical, automatic daze, because I was told that I must reach the prescribed spot in time. As I inched over the sea of snow, I listened to other voices that wondered what people were doing in Sheffield, and remembered the thatched cottage pub in Harrow, where I used to drink before the expedition. I hoped that Ma was praying for me as she always did, and at the memory of her my eyes blurred wetly with hot tears. I sang lyrics of a pop song incessantly to the tune of my crawling, and kept filling my head with countless thoughts and images until I stopped and sat swaying in the heat. Then the voice would tell me I was late, and I would wake with a start and crawl again. I was split in two. A cold, clinical side of me assessed everything, decided what to do, and made me do it. The rest was madness, a hazy blur of images so vivid and real that I lost myself in their spell. I began to wonder whether I was hallucinating. A film of weariness enveloped everything. Events passed in slow motion, and thoughts became so confused I lost all sense of time passing. When I stopped, I would make an excuse for it, so as not to feel guilty. My frostbitten fingers became the most common excuse. I had to take my mitts and inner gloves off to check that they were not getting worse. 10 minutes later, the voice would jolt me back to reality, and I would pull on the glove I had only half managed to remove, and tug my mitt over it, and crawl. My hands were always deep in the snow as I crawled, and when they had gone numb, I would stop again and stare at them. I meant to massage them, or remove the gloves and heat them in the sun, but I just stared at them blankly, until the voice called me. After 2 hours, the circular crevasse was behind me, and I had escaped the shadow of Sulu Grande. I followed the footprints in a crescent under Yerapaja's south face, passing the broken side of a crevasse which thrust out from the glacier snow. It was only 50 feet long, but I passed it like a ship passes an iceberg. I drifted slowly by, staring at the bared ice. I seemed to be drifting with it on a current. It didn't strike me as odd that I wasn't overtaking the ice cliff. I gazed at figures in the broken ice of the cliff. I was unsure whether I could really see them. Voices argued with the commanding voice and decided I was seeing them. They reminded me of an old man's head I had once seen in a cloud while lying on a beach. My friend couldn't see it, which had made me angry, because even if I looked away and then back at the cloud, I could still see the old man, so it had to be there. It looked like a Renaissance painting in the Sistine Chapel, where the white-bearded old man pointing his finger from the ceiling was supposed to be God. There was nothing pious about the figures I watched in the ice. Many figures, some half-formed, all frozen in bas-relief, stood out starkly from the cliff face. Sun shadows and colours in the ice gave them solidity. All were copulating. I was fascinated, and crawled steadily as I gawped at the obscene figures in the ice. I had seen these figures before as well. They reminded me of pictures I had seen of the carvings inside a Hindu temple. There was no order in the chaos of figures. They stood, or kneeled, or were lying down. Some were upside down, and I had to cock my head to make out what they were doing. It was funny and titillating, like the paintings by Titian of grossly fat nudes that had mesmerized me at 14. A short while later, I sat still in the snow with a mitt in my lap, tugging at an inner glove with my teeth. The cliff was no longer in sight. Between seeing the figures and stopping to check my fingers, I had no memory of doing anything. One moment I was looking at the ice figures, the next I was alone again, and the cliff mysteriously was behind me. A spray of icy snow crystal stung my face. The wind was getting up. I looked at the sky and was surprised to see that a rolling carpet of heavy cumulus had covered the sun. Another gust of wind made me turn my face away. A storm was building. It was cold in the wind, which had sprung up from nowhere and now buffeted me with increasing force. I hurriedly pulled on my mitt and turned to face the footprints. I was less dazed now, and the voice had banished the mad thoughts from my mind. An urgency was creeping over me, and the voice said, "Go on. Keep going. Faster. You've wasted too much time. Go on before you lose the tracks." And I tried hard to hurry. The wind gusted fine clouds across the glacier ahead of me. They swirled low over the surface. Sometimes they covered me and I could see no more than a few yards, but if I sat up, I could see over the fine spindrift that scooted across the glacier, making it look as if the glacier were rushing forward in whirls and eddies. I wondered what people would think to see this head and torso sticking out from the glacier. I lay on my side and crawled in fast bursts, before popping my head above the stormy curtain again to peer forward. There was snow in the air above, fresh, falling snow. My stomach tightened as panic threatened. The snow and wind would hide the footprints. The voice said I would lose my way, said I would never get through the crevasses without the prints, and told me to hurry on. But what I was really frightened of was losing a sign of life in the empty bowl of mountains surrounding me. I had followed the footprints happily, as if Simon were just up ahead and I wasn't alone. Now the wind and snow threatened to leave me utterly alone. I clawed feverishly through the gusting snow, squinting ahead at the rapidly fading tracks. The light faded quickly. Night was approaching, and with it the wind grew stronger. I didn't waste time warming my frozen hands, but urgently followed the soft marks of filled-in footprints until I could see no more. It was dark. I lay face down in the snow, defeated. The strenuous crawling had warmed me, and I could lie still, feeling the wind pushing snow up around me without being cold. I wanted to sleep. I couldn't be bothered to move any more. I was warm enough sleeping on the snow. The storm would cover me like a husky and keep me warm. I nearly slept, dozing fitfully, edging close to the dark comfort of sleep, but the wind kept waking me. I tried to ignore the voice which urged me to move, but couldn't because the other voices had gone. I couldn't lose the voice in daydreams. "Don't sleep, don't sleep, not here. Keep going. Find a slope and dig a snow hole. Don't sleep." The darkness and the storm confused me. I lost track of how long I moved through the snow, and even forgot that I was on a glacier with crevasses all around me. I kept crawling forward blindly. Once there was a roaring, louder than the wind, and a sudden blast of ice fragments hit me, an avalanche or a cornice falling from Yerapaja into the glacier. I registered that it hit me, its force spent and swept over me. Then the wind noise returned and I forgot the avalanche. It never occurred to me that I might have been in danger. Suddenly I rolled forward and fell. In the dark I couldn't make out what I had slid into with a rush. As I came to a stop, I turned and faced the way I had come. There was a bank of snow above me, and I groped my way back up it, dragging at the snow with my axes, hopping and crying out with the pains in my knee. I dug the snow hole in a confusion of pain and exhaustion. As I burrowed into the bank, I was forced to twist and turn to enlarge the hole, so wrenching my knee excruciatingly from side to side. The other voices returned once I was sheltered from the wind, and I dozed off with their images idly flitting through my mind. I jolted awake and started digging to the repeated tune of a song in my head, then dozed, then back to my voices. I fumbled in my rucksack with unfeeling hands for my head torch. I pulled my sleeping bag from the sack and found the torch inside. With its feeble dying light, I saw that the cave wasn't long enough for me to lie stretched out, but I was too tired to carry on digging. Leaning forward to remove my crampons put unbearable pressure on my damaged knee. I groaned and sobbed with frustration as my deadened fingers flicked ineffectually over the heel release bar. I couldn't grip the bar hard enough to pull the crampon from my boot. I was bent double over my legs, trying to avoid breaking the roof of the cave with my head, and cried with pain and impotent fury. I stopped pulling at the bar and sat quietly, until the idea to use my axe came to me. The bar on each boot popped off easily with the leverage from the axe. I lay back in the cave and dozed. Hours seemed to pass before I had laid out the insulation mat and struggled into my sleeping bag. Hefting my broken leg into the bag was awkward and pain-racked. The boot snagged on the wet fabric of the bag, jerking fire from the knee joint. My leg felt amazingly heavy when I lifted it into the bag, and it felt dead and lumpy. It got in the way like a pestering child, making me irritable, as if it was something I ordered around and it stubbornly refused to obey. There was no sound of the storm raging outside. Occasionally I felt the wind tug at the end of the sleeping bag protruding from the entrance, and then this also fell quiet as the snow covered my feet and sealed the cave. I checked my watch. 10:30. I knew I must sleep, yet now that it was safe to sleep I felt sharply awake. Memories of the crevasse came back in the dark of the cave and forced hopes of sleep away. My knee throbbed unmercifully. I worried about getting frostbitten feet and thought of my fingers. It occurred to me that I might not wake up if I fell asleep, so I kept my eyes open and stared into the dark. I knew I was being scared unnecessarily by such thoughts now that it was dark and I had nothing more to do, but it didn't help. Eventually I slept in a dreamless black stupor. The night was long and silent while the storm blew itself out on the snows above me, and from time to time pain and childish fears ambushed my sleep.
It was late when I awoke. The sun glowed through the tent walls, making me uncomfortably hot in my sleeping bag. I lay motionless, staring at the domed roof. It seemed incredible that at this time yesterday I had been stumbling through the crevasses at the end of the glacier. Joe had been dead 36 hours. I felt as if he had been gone for weeks. Yet it was only 7 days since we had set off together up the mountain. There was a hollow ache inside, which no food could fill. It would pass with time. Already he was a vaguely recollected memory. It was strange how I couldn't picture his face in my mind. So, he was gone, and there was nothing I could do to change it. I fumbled with numb fingers to release the sleeping bag draw cord, shuffled it off me, and went out to the sun. I was hungry. Richard was busy priming the petrol stove by the cooking rock. He glanced at me and smiled. It was a beautiful day. One of those days to make you feel good and zestful. I went to the riverbed and urinated on a boulder. Serapo loomed in front of me, but its spectacular beauty no longer interested me. I was bored with this place and these pretty views. There was no point in being here. It was barren and lifeless. I hated the place for its cruelty, and for what it had made me do. I wondered whether I had murdered him. I walked back to Richard and hunkered down beside him, in a black, despairing mood. He silently handed me a cup of tea and a bowl of milky porridge. I ate quickly and tasted little. When I had finished, I walked over to the tent, collected my washing things, and made my way to a deep pool in the river. I stripped off and stepped into the freezing water, dipping myself hurriedly under and gasping as the cold took my breath away. The sun dried me and warmed my back as I shaved. I spent a long time by the pool, cleaning my clothes and picking at the sunburn on my face. It was a peaceful, cleansing ritual, and my despair gradually faded as I mulled over the past few days. When I walked back to the tents, it was with a fresh spirit. It had happened, and I had done everything possible. Okay, he was dead, and I wasn't, but that was no reason for tormenting myself. I had to get things straight in my own mind before I could return and face the inevitable criticism. I knew that once I had accepted it all, then I could tell others. They would never know what it had been like, and I doubted whether I could ever articulate it, even to close friends. But I didn't have to, so long as it felt right inside. The healing process had started. For the moment, I was content. Richard had left the camp when I returned. I searched round the tent looking for the medicine box. It lay partly hidden by some of Joe's clothes at the back of the tent. I threw it onto the grass outside and then sifted through his things. After 15 minutes, there was a pile of clothes and possessions lying in the sun by the medicines. I sat beside them, opened the medicine kit, and began systematically to dose myself. I swallowed Ronicols to improve the circulation in my fingers and prevent the frostbite taking too deep a hold. Wide-spectrum antibiotics followed to combat infection. Then another drawn-out session of picking, cleaning, and inspecting followed. It was wonderfully restorative. The ritualized examination seemed to confirm to me that everything was back to normal. It was a luxury and a balm. Feet, fingers, face, hair, chest, and legs all got the treatment. When I had finished, I turned to the pile of possessions and began sorting through them. I placed all his clothes in one pile and laid out his possessions in a line to one side. I felt quite calm and mechanical as I separated them. I found his used film and a zoom lens in a plastic bag. It was a large bag, so I gathered all the things I wanted to give to his parents and put them in as well. There wasn't much. I found his diary. He had written something almost every day, even on the plane from London. He liked writing. I glanced through it, but didn't read the words. I didn't want to know what he had said. I ignored what climbing equipment he had left behind. It was of no value to anyone but a climber. I would pack it home with my gear. When I turned to his clothes, I flicked through them quickly. I soon found his hat. It was a black and white patterned woolly hat with its bobble missing. I knew he had really liked it, and I placed it in the bag with the rest. It came from Czechoslovakia. Miri Schmidt had given it to him in Chamonix. I couldn't bring myself to burn it. Richard came back just as I had finished with what I would give to Joe's parents. He fetched some petrol, and we burnt the clothes in the riverbed. The trousers wouldn't burn well, and we had to use a lot of petrol. Richard had suggested we should give them to the girls and the kids down in the valley. They would have liked to have them, as their clothes were so tattered. But I went ahead and burnt them. When it was over, we returned to the cooking rock and sat quietly in the sun. Richard made a hot meal and provided endless cups of tea. We played cards or listened to music on the personal stereos. Richard went and fetched Joe's stereo from the plastic bag because his was broken, and the day passed idly. When we talked, it was quietly, and about home or future plans. The hollow feeling was still with me, and the guilt, which I knew I could never erase. But I could deal with it now.
11. A Land Without Pity. I awoke screaming. It was light in the snow cave and cold. The nightmare subsided slowly, and I remembered where I was. It wasn't the crevasse. The relief washed over me as I tried to forget the dream. I lay still, looking at the rough snow roof above me. It was deathly quiet, and I wondered whether the storm was still raging above me. I didn't want to move. It was going to hurt after the long, cold night. I twitched my leg gingerly and was rewarded with a stab of sharp pain from my knee. My breath clouded onto the snow roof, and I watched it vacantly. The dream had been so vividly clear that I believed it to be true. I had seen myself back on the ice bridge, crumpled against the crevasse wall, sobbing. I saw myself sobbing, but could hear no sounds. Instead, a voice, my voice, recited a soliloquy from Shakespeare over and over again. "I but to die and go we know not where, to lie in cold obstruction and to rot, this sensible warm motion to become a kneaded clod." I was awake now and knew exactly where I was, but the words still echoed in my head, and I remembered where I had learnt them. 10 years ago I had recited those words in just the same parrot fashion. Over and over again I had said them aloud in my room, trying to memorize them word perfectly for the O-level literature exam in the morning. I was astounded. I hadn't read the lines since that time, and yet now I could remember every word. And the delighted spirit, to bathe in fiery floods or to reside in thrilling region of thick-ribbed ice, to be imprisoned in the viewless winds and blown with restless violence round about the pendant world. I felt delighted, and muttered the words to the silent snows around me, listening to the odd acoustics of the cave. I chuckled to myself, and began again when I could remember no further. I forgot how frightening it had all sounded in the dream as I became more adventurous and bellowed the words out in my best Laurence Olivier voice, all the time lying flat on my back in my sleeping bag, with my nose protruding from the hood. Or to be worse than worst, of those that lawless and incertain thought imagine howling, "'Tis too horrible, the weariest and most loathed worldly life that age, ache, penury and imprisonment can lay on nature is a paradise to what we fear of death." When at last I tired of the game, the silence was overwhelming. My boisterous mood vanished, and I felt despairingly lonely and silly. I thought of what the words meant, and of the dream, and was close to tears. My feet had been buried by drifting snow, and I yelled at the burning stabs in my knee when I tried to kick them free. While I struggled to roll the wet, clinging sleeping bag back over my lower legs, I accidentally broke a hole in the cave roof. Bright sunshine suddenly burnt away the snow shadows in the cave, and I knew at once that the storm was over. I reached for my axe and swept away the rest of the roof. It was going to be a hot day. The sun rapidly melted away the cold night shivers, and I sat in the hole that was left of the cave, gazing around me. At my feet, a slope ran down to an old snow-filled crevasse. I was facing the moraines, but I couldn't see them from the glacier. Everything was white and alarmingly smooth. The storm had made a good job of covering the footprints I had been following the previous night. For as far as I could see, the surface of the glacier undulated away in unblemished waves of fresh snow. As I slowly packed the bag into my sack and fumbled to roll up my carry-mat with numb fingers, I realized how desperately thirsty I was. If it had been bad yesterday, I couldn't imagine what it would be like today. I tried to think where the nearest flowing water might be. I could remember seeing water only at Bomb Alley, and that was miles away. I would be lucky to reach it today. As soon as the thought struck me, I was shocked to see how planned everything had become. I couldn't remember consciously deciding how long it would take to get to camp, yet there was no doubt that I had done so, for I had already dismissed any hope of reaching Bomb Alley. Strange things seemed to be going on in my head. I had no clear memory of the sequence of events on the previous day. Vague snatches of unconnected memories came to me, the hollow floor in the crevasse, and the sunbeam, an avalanche blast in the storm, falling down the slope where I snowholed, and that obscene ice cliff. But where had the rest of the day gone? Was this due to lack of food and water? How many days had I been without them? 3 days. No, 2 days and 3 nights. God almighty, the thought appalled me. I knew that at this height I needed to consume at least 1.5 liters of fluid each day just to combat the dehydration of altitude. I was running on empty. Food did not worry me. I wasn't hungry. And although I must have burnt up a huge amount of energy, I still felt that I had reserves. but the way my tongue felt thick and coated and kept sticking to my palate frightened me. The smell of water in the sun-heated snow surrounding me drove me close to panic. Eating snow quenched the dryness in my mouth for a short time, but I dared not think what was happening inside. It just wasn't possible to eat enough snow to stave off that urgent need for liquid. Whatever planning I had done subconsciously seemed pretty futile as I looked at the snow rolling into the distance. I wasn't going to make it. Jesus, is that how it's going to be? Just crawling to a standstill for the sake of water. I slid down the slope and began to crawl away from the snow cave. I thought that I would try to reach the moraines by midday and see how things looked then. Sitting on the glacier feeling worried wasn't going to get me very far. Perhaps I wouldn't make it. Maybe I would. I didn't care that much, so long as I kept moving and occupied. It was frightening and lonely to wait for it to come to me. I crawled carefully. Since there were no tracks to follow, it was vital to try and keep my bearings. I knew that the crevasses were wide and numerous over to my left, so I hugged the right bank of the glacier, which curved round beneath Yerapaha. Every now and then I hopped unsteadily onto my good foot to look ahead. The increased view never failed to surprise me. I could see far enough ahead to make out distinctive crevasses, which I remembered from our outward trek. However, the nagging fear of unexpected crevasses wore me down, and I became increasingly conscious of how vulnerable I was while crawling. After an hour, I convinced myself that I might be able to walk. My leg, sliding smoothly along behind me, seemed less painful. It occurred to me that I might only have torn some muscles in my knee, and now, after a night's rest, and it being so long since I had hurt it, perhaps it had got sufficiently better to take my weight. I stood up and swayed on my good leg, letting my right foot lie gently on the snow. I pressed down slowly. There was some pain, but nothing I couldn't bear. I knew it would hurt, but with a bit of determination, I reckoned I could keep walking through it. I braced myself and stepped forward onto my right leg. There was a twisting slip inside the joint, and bones grated sickeningly. I lay face down in the snow, unsure whether I had passed out or not. Nausea threatened to swamp up my throat, making me gasp and retch. Agony boiled from my knee, and I sobbed and cursed at my stupidity. It felt as if I had broken it all over again. The cold bite of the snow on my face cleared the dizziness. I sat up and ate some snow to wash away the bitter sting of bile in my mouth, and then sat slumped forward. When I had stood up, the first series of crevasses running down to the moraines had been visible 100 yards ahead. As I couldn't walk, I would be forced to crawl through the broken section, unable to see far enough ahead to be sure of taking the correct line. Now that I considered it, I wasn't certain of the line anyway. I remembered that we had weaved a complex path across the 150 yards of parallel crevasses between me and the moraines, sometimes crossing narrow bridges dividing crevasses, and frequently climbing short steep slopes to avoid the open holes. I doubted that I would be able to control a crawling descent of these obstacles. I lay back on my rucksack and stared at the sky. My instinct screamed out against attempting the crossing, but my brain could find no alternatives. I ate snow mechanically and drifted into daydreams, abdicating from the inevitable decision to move. There were no clouds to look at, no birds flying by. Yet I still lay there, eyes open but unseeing, and thought of anything but where I was. I awoke with a start. Get moving. Don't lie there. Stop dozing. Move. The voice came through the wandering idle thoughts of pop song lyrics, faces from the past, and fantasies of empty value. I set off crawling, trying to force the pace to salve my guilty conscience. I gave no further thought to what the crevasses might hold for me. With frequent stops to stand and check the route, I slowly entered the crevasse zone. Dips in the smooth snow made me veer anxiously from side to side, and when I turned to look back, my sloughed tracks meandered crazily in loops and zigzags back to the smooth surface on which I had slept. As in a maze, I thought at first that I knew where I was going. At last, I realized I was hopelessly lost. The splits in the ice became more contorted and numerous until I stood up and stared at a broken mess of fissures and covered hollows. It was impossible to judge where I was in relation to the vague map in my mind. I would recognize a crevasse, then look again and see that I was mistaken. Each one changed shape when I glanced at it a second time, and my head was swimming with the effort of concentration. A mounting horror of falling into a crevasse forced me into frantic guessing at the best path through the maze. The harder I tried, the worse my position became, until hysteria threatened to overwhelm me. Which way? Which way? Over there. And there I would crawl, only to find myself dead-ended by another menacing fissure. Time seemed to slow as I crawled back and forth. I crossed and recrossed my tracks, forgot what I had already seen until I looked at a taunting gap in front of my face once again. I fought the temptation to jump the smaller crevasses, narrow gaps which normally I would have jumped unhesitatingly, but dared not risk leaping off one leg. Even if I cleared the gap, I might slide uncontrollably into the parallel yawning slit immediately ahead. In a state of nervous exhaustion, I collapsed on a narrow bridge of snow between two crevasses. I lay on my side, looking bleakly at the narrowing bridge stretching away from me. There was something familiar about the bridge, yet I couldn't recall what it was. I had collapsed in despair when I saw that the bridge narrowed, convinced that once again I would have to retreat. I had already approached this bridge several times before, but now I thought there was something significant about it. On the previous occasions, I hadn't dared attempt to stand on the narrow strip of snow for fear of the open holes on either side. I sat up and searched intently for some remembered landmark in the snows ahead. The bridge appeared to curl to the left and drop away. I would be certain that the building excitement within me was justified only if I stood up. Using my axe, I tentatively straightened up, swaying alarmingly and feeling very unsteady. Beyond the bridge, I saw the dark outline of a boulder on a flat snow slope. It was the beginning of the moraines. I dropped back to the bridge and crawled carefully to its narrowest point. The curl to the left led to the snow-covered moraines. There were no more crevasses. I sat with my back against a large yellow rock, staring at my tracks coming down off the glacier. They weaved crazily through the broken ice, as if some giant bird had been hopping around feeding on the snow. I felt utterly drained. It suddenly struck me as funny that I should have taken such a daft route through the crevasses, now that I could see clearly the obvious line. There was a taint of hysteria in my good humour, and the waves of weak shivers running through me left me in no doubt that I had been very lucky to get safely across. The glacier shimmered and waved before my eyes, so that its gentle rolls seemed to move like the ocean. I rubbed my eyes and looked again. There was a blurred quality to the view before me, and when I turned to look at the dark moraines tumbling towards the lakes, I noticed that these too appeared hazy and out of focus. The more I rubbed my eyes, the worse the blurring became, and sharp, prickling burns made tears cloud my sight. Snowblind. Oh, shit, that's the last thing I need. My sunglasses had smashed when I had fallen from the cliff and broken my leg, and I had been unable to take out my contact lenses for the last 2 days and nights. I squinted my eyes tight and peered through the smallest of slits. When I looked at the blinding glare of the glacier, my eyes burned unbearably, and fat tears rolled down my cheeks. The dark moraines were softer, and I found that I could focus quite well there through slitted eyelids. I moved awkwardly to the other side of the boulder, facing the moraines, and that small distance of hopping confirmed my dread that the glacier was the easy part. I lolled against the rock, feeling luxuriously warm and relaxed in the sun. I promised myself a good rest before attempting the moraines, and immediately nodded into sleep. After half an hour, the voice rudely disturbed my peace, coming into my dreams like the distant murmur of flowing water, with the same insistent message I had so far been unable to ignore. "Come on, wake up. Things to be done. Long way to go. Don't sleep. Come on!" I sat up and stared in confusion at the dark river of rock flowing away from me. For a moment I felt disorientated and wondered where I was. All those rocks. They were strange after so many days on the snow. I hadn't seen so much rock since before the summit. How long ago was that? It took several bemused attempts before I worked it out. 4 days ago. It meant nothing to me. 4 days, six, what did it matter? Nothing ever seemed to change. I had been in these mountains so long I felt as if I must remain here in this half-dream state, waking occasionally in stark reality to remember the reasons for being here, before drifting back to the comfort of fantasy. Rocks. The moraines, of course. I lay back against the boulder and closed my eyes, but the voice kept calling. Instructions tumbled in, repeated commands of what I must do, and I lay back listening and fighting the instinct to obey. I just wanted to sleep a little longer. I lost the fight and obeyed. The melody of a song continued to play in my head as I organized myself. I found that I could vocalize all the lyrics word perfectly, yet I was sure I had only been able to remember